It's Sunday, May 10th. Today we're looking at a massive structural gutting of the DOJ's corruption units, a push for a new economic agenda in Congress, and a fascinating shift in the American family tree. We're also talking about the fallout from the Kentucky Derby and why the winner is already causing a stir. First, on the domestic front, the Trump administration is significantly pulling back on the prosecution of public corruption. The Justice Department's Public Integrity Section, which historically employed 35 to 40 attorneys to investigate corrupt officials, has reportedly been gutted down to just 2 lawyers. Consequently, the unit's caseload has plummeted. This follows a pattern of executive action, with President Trump issuing at least 15 pardons to former elected officials and associates convicted of corruption, a volume described by some legal experts as a hailstorm of leniency. This isn't just about high-profile political favors. It's a structural dismantling. When you cut a specialized unit from 40 lawyers to 2, you aren't streamlining, you're closing up shop. This hits rural areas and smaller states the hardest because they don't have the local resources to take on complex corruption cases themselves. The signal being sent is pretty clear. If you're in power, the guardrails are officially down. It's an open invitation for official malfeasance to become the new baseline for how the government functions. Turning to the domestic political response, the Congressional Progressive Caucus is attempting to pivot the Democratic brand by launching a new 10-point affordability agenda. This strategy moves away from culture war issues and focuses instead on concrete economic pain points, lowering utility bills, reducing childcare costs, and capping prescription drug prices. Congressman Greg Kassar, a leading voice in the caucus, argues that this isn't a retreat from progressive values, but a pragmatic way to build a winning coalition. The agenda includes specific goals like banning surveillance pricing, where companies use data to hike prices for specific customers, and expanding down payment assistance for homebuyers. The goal is to connect climate action directly to consumer savings, such as through home electrification. Honestly, it's about time. For years, Progressive has been successfully branded by the right as a list of academic grievances, but this is a play for the kitchen table issues that actually win elections. If they can actually convince people that a green transition means a smaller electric bill rather than just a lecture on carbon footprints, they might actually have a shot at reclaiming the working-class voters they've been hemorrhaging. Senator Raphael Warnock recently spoke out on the poverty of moral imagination currently infecting American politics. Appearing on Pod Save America, Warnock argued that the political landscape has become a race for self-interest that ignores foundational principles of equity and voting rights. He specifically called out the Supreme Court's dismantling of voting protections, framing it as an attempt to remake the U.S. into a dystopian Jim Crow image. Warnock's critique also extended to how the nation allocates its wealth. He argued that the U.S. doesn't lack the resources for healthcare or childcare. It lacks the moral will to prioritize people over endless wars. He also issued a warning to his own party about the danger of using alienating jargon and privatizing faith, which he says allows extremists to co-opt moral language. Warnock is pointing to a very real vacuum. When the left stops talking about right and wrong and starts talking exclusively in policy white papers and HR-approved terminology, they lose the ability to speak to the soul of the country. He's essentially saying that if you don't give people a moral vision for why their lives are hard, someone else, usually someone with much darker motives, will fill that gap for you. Finally, we're seeing a significant shift in the American family structure. A growing number of women are choosing intentional single motherhood, a trend that is fundamentally redefining the traditional family unit. Demographic data shows that unmarried women over 30 are now the fastest-growing segment of single parents. These are women with established careers and financial stability who are choosing to use IVF or sperm donation to start families without a partner. The reporting highlights women like Stephanie Gobler, a 43-year-old architect, and Nilo Rahman, who had twins at 41, who described this as a deliberate act of agency rather than a fallback plan. This is also sparking a change in how communities are built. Many of these mothers are creating villages by buying adjacent homes with siblings or friends to share childcare and support. This is a fascinating middle finger to the traditional values panic we hear so much about. These women aren't falling into single motherhood, they're engineering it with more stability and intentionality than a lot of two-parent households have. It shows that the nuclear family isn't the only way to raise a kid, and as reproductive tech gets better, the idea that you have to wait for the right guy to start your life is becoming a relic of the past. While the social fabric is shifting at home, the digital fabric of our lives is being restitched by algorithms. Atlassian is moving to integrate AI into the actual plumbing of how companies function, rather than just treating it as a chatbot on the side. According to recent reports, the company is building out what they call the teamwork graph. The idea here is to feed an AI model a massive amount of organizational context, everything from your company's code and employee skill sets to its physical assets. They're doing this through a platform called Robo and a command line interface that allows AI agents to tap into that internal data. The goal is to move past superficial metrics and focus on actual output. Basically, Atlassian is betting that the companies who win will be the ones that stop using AI for incremental tweaks and start using it as a fundamental component of their operations. Look, it's a smart play to lock people into their ecosystem, but it also highlights a widening gap. You're either building an AI-native culture where agents do the heavy lifting, or you're just the person at the desk typing prompts into a box and hoping for the best. On the dating front, the industry is looking at a radical shift from simple matching to what's being called deep behavioral evaluation. As reported, AI platforms are being designed to analyze your entire digital footprint, your purchases, your playlists, your social media, to create a searchable truth about who you are. The pitch is safety. 23% of users report being catfished, and romance scams cost billions every year. AI could theoretically filter out the scammers by providing an unfiltered assessment of a person's character. But there's a massive catch. Research shows that individual traits, the stuff an AI can scan, only account for a small fraction of relationship success. The real weight comes from the specific dynamic that emerges between two people over time. Beyond the math, there's a real, searchable self conundrum here. If your entire history is permanently legible to an algorithm, the right to grow or reinvent yourself basically disappears. For kids growing up now, every impulsive decision or immature phase is baked into their permanent record. It's a pretty bleak trade-off. We're essentially asking if we want love to be an optimized selection mechanism or an actual human encounter. And for the small business owners and agency side of things, the focus is shifting toward automating the mundane to save what's left of our attention spans. According to agency owner Caitlin Sturdy, the move right now is using tools like Zapier to bridge the gap between AI and workflow. We're seeing a jump from simple tasks like auto-posting a blog to much more complex, intelligent automations. For example, agencies are now using AI to score resumes against job descriptions and trigger follow-up tasks without a human ever touching the keyboard. The argument is that by offloading the administrative overhead, teams can actually get back to the creative work. It sounds great in theory, but it also means the bar for human work just got a lot higher. If the AI is doing the sorting, the summarizing, and the scheduling, you'd better be damn sure the strategic work you're doing is actually worth the premium. There's also a growing legal tension here that we need to keep an eye on. While these AI tools want more data to be more accurate, global privacy laws are moving the other way. Between the EU's right to erasure and California's Delete Act, there is a literal legal right to be forgotten. We're headed for a collision between the AI companies that want to archive your entire life for transparency and the laws designed to let you delete the version of yourself that you've outgrown. Honestly, in a world where everything is recorded, the most valuable thing you might own is the right to be a mystery. Speaking of things that are hard to predict, let's look at what just happened on the track. Sovereignty just took the 151st Kentucky Derby in a victory for trainer Bill Mott. But the fallout from the race is exposing some pretty deep cracks in how the sport actually functions. the facts of the race itself were wild. Sovereignty ran a patient trip to secure the win, but the celebration was short-lived for the sport's traditionalists. For the second year in a row, the Derby winner is officially skipping the Preakness Stakes. Sovereignty's team announced they're bypassing the second leg of the Triple Crown to head straight to the Belmont. This is becoming a massive problem for the industry. The whole point of the Triple Crown is the 5-week sprint, and when the Derby winner bails, it sucks the air out of the room. There's a real debate now about whether the Preakness needs a bigger purse or if the schedule itself is just broken. Look, I get wanting to rest the horse, but if the stars don't show up, the Triple Crown is just 3 random races on a calendar. Then there's the betting situation, which according to the post-race analysis, looked incredibly shady to the average fan. Some horses saw their odds plummet after the field had already left the starting gate. This happens because of computer-assisted wagering, basically high-speed algorithms dumping money into the pool at the last possible millisecond. It makes the retail bettors feel like the game is rigged, even if it's technically legal. The industry is being urged to update its TERT technology to show real-time odds, because right now, seeing the numbers shift while the horses are mid-sprint is a terrible look. We also saw some weird logistical inconsistencies. When a horse is scratched late, the current protocol at Churchill Downs is to shift the neighboring horses inward to keep the field compact, rather than just leaving the rail horse where they are. It's confusing, it's inefficient, and it's the kind of "we've always done it this way" logic that's driving people crazy. On a more human note, the race also served as the launchpad for the Jockeys Guild Education Foundation. It's a new initiative to help riders get GEDs or technical training because, frankly, most of these kids drop out of school to ride and have zero backup plan when they eventually stop. It's a rare bit of foresight in a sport that usually only cares about what happens in the 2 minutes between the gate and the wire. The business of watching those horses and everything else is also going through a bit of a midlife crisis of its own. Disney has officially decided against spinning off ESPN. Despite the network no longer being the automatic engine for stock value it once was, the company is doubling down on a different strategy. According to recent reports, they're choosing to fold ESPN into a broader digital bundle alongside Disney Plus and Hulu. It turns out the value of a sports giant in the coming years isn't just about collecting cable fees, it's about being the premium anchor for a streaming suite. This shift is happening while the NFL continues its high-stakes media rights negotiations. The league is currently being lobbied by figures like Rupert Murdoch, who are trying to manage the escalating costs of live sports. While there's a push toward streaming, the expectation is that the NFL will stick with broadcast television for its core games. Moving the big games to streaming would likely trigger a political backlash, so any shift to digital will probably stay limited to niche games or supplementary content for now. It's a classic "if it ain't broke, don't fix it" approach, mostly because the NFL is the only thing keeping the lights on for traditional TV. The leverage in these rooms is shifting too. We're seeing a debundling of talent, where individual creators are realizing they don't actually need the big networks. Platforms like Substack and TikTok have made it so a person with a camera can be their own media conglomerate. Look at the Pat McAfee deal with ESPN. He didn't just sign a contract, he kept his independence while using their megaphone. Media executives are finding out the hard way that you can't just buy a digital star and expect their audience to follow. When Barstool's Dave Portnoy moved content to Fox Sports 1, it flopped. It turns out the kids don't want to watch their favorite YouTuber on a linear TV schedule, which honestly shouldn't be a surprise to anyone who has met a person under 30. Then there's the UFC, which just keeps proving the skeptics wrong. After being bought for $2 million in 2001, it's now hitting valuation milestones like a $7.7 billion deal with Paramount. Dana White's whole strategy has been about eating the financial risk himself. The UFC famously spent $10 million of its own money to fund The Ultimate Fighter just so they could keep the rights to the content. It was a hell of a gamble that paid off because they own the tape. White's approach is basically the anti-corporate playbook. He swears he gives TikTokers unrestricted access to his footage, and he stayed open during the pandemic, when everyone else folded. It's raw, it's often shitty, and it's completely unfiltered. Compare that to the canned statements you get from every other league commissioner. The UFC is built on the idea that authenticity, even the ugly kind, sells better than a polished PR deck. If the media giants are struggling to figure out the bundle, local news is finding that the only real bundle that works is the one tied to the community. Local news organizations are moving away from the silver bullet theory of survival. According to recent research on the industry, the path to staying solvent now relies on a diversified revenue model that balances localized philanthropy, subscriptions, and business support services. It's a shift toward a publisher's mindset, where the business fundamentals are being treated with the same urgency as the reporting itself. The data shows it takes about 5 years for a local newsroom to establish a stable revenue base. That's a long time to keep the lights on while waiting for a community to start paying the bills. To shorten that window, organizations are increasingly seeking what's called catalytic capital, upfront investments of $1 million or more, specifically earmarked for the business side of the house. The logic is straightforward. If you spend that money on professionalizing your revenue operations rather than just hiring more reporters, you can potentially increase your annual revenue by that same $1 million mark. Look, for decades, the church and state divide between the newsroom and the sales office was a point of pride in journalism. You didn't want the people selling ads talking to the people writing the stories because, well, humans are corruptible. But that wall is coming down out of sheer necessity. The research suggests that for these newsrooms to survive, journalists have to embrace an integrated approach where they actually engage with the business side to understand community needs. Honestly, it's about damn time. The starving artist vibe in local news was only sustainable when department stores were buying full-page ads every Sunday. Those days are gone. If you aren't thinking about how to embed your organization into the community's donor base and membership structures, you aren't being pure, you're just being short-sighted. While this model is showing results for well-funded startups and major hubs, there is a catch. The research notes that extending this success to lower population areas and underserved audiences is still a massive hurdle. It turns out that having $1 million in catalytic capital is a lot easier if you're in a city with a high concentration of wealthy donors. The emerging trend of state tax benefits for local news is on the radar, but it hasn't replaced the need for old-fashioned donor support and earned revenue yet. The takeaway here is that the business of news isn't a dirty phrase anymore. It's the only way the news actually gets written. It's a cynical reality, maybe, but at least it's a reality with a roadmap. While the newsrooms are professionalizing, the rest of us are just trying to keep our brains from turning to mush. Small cap and international stocks are currently outperforming the S&P 500, marking a shift in market dynamics that challenges the recent dominance of large U.S. companies. According to research reported on the 401k Inertia podcast, the perceived slump in small cap stocks is actually an illusion caused by fallen angels and new IPOs dragging down the averages, while established small firms remain strong. Look, the S&P 500 has been the easy button for a decade, but these numbers suggest the party might be moving elsewhere. On the retirement front, the timing of your exit could impact your brain. Studies indicate that retiring before age 65 can actually accelerate cognitive decline, particularly for men between 51 and 64. The data suggests that staying in the workforce, or at least staying mentally engaged, is a prerequisite for maintaining cognitive health. This comes as the U.S. debt-to-GDP ratio has officially crossed the 100% threshold, a level we haven't seen since World War II. It's a grim irony. You have to keep working to stay sharp, partly because the national balance sheet looks like a disaster. If you're struggling with those big career or financial goals, the advice is to stop swinging for the fences. The Micro Commitments podcast reports that breaking massive objectives into micro commitments, like sending exactly 10 emails instead of clearing your inbox, is the only way to bypass psychological paralysis. The goal is to set targets so small they are impossible to fail, creating a stack of daily wins that builds actual confidence. It's basically the eat the elephant cliche, but with an emphasis on the fact that failing at a huge goal is just a choice to be miserable. Finally, true resilience isn't about being a lone wolf. Recent reporting on interdependence suggests that independence is often just a mask for isolation. The key is establishing emotional boundaries, especially in families where family is everything, is used as a guilt trip. Setting these boundaries is going to feel shitty at first, but the research shows that the resentment from being a doormat eventually destroys relationships faster than the temporary discomfort of saying no. A few other things worth knowing before you head out. Historians usually obsess over Marcus Aurelius's mentors, but it turns out his mother, Domitia Lucilla, was the real architect of his stoicism. She didn't just teach him the theory, she modeled the actual discipline of not being a prick, even when you have the power to be one. It's a good reminder that behind every philosopher king is usually a woman who spent years making sure he didn't grow up to be a total disaster. Over in the UK, we're getting a clearer look at how the British government basically engineered their own nightmare with the IRA in the 70s. By stripping IRA prisoners of their special category status and forcing them into standard prison uniforms, the state tried to rebrand a political conflict as simple thuggery. It backfired spectacularly, leading to the blanket protests and hunger strikes that turned prisoners into martyrs and radicalized a whole new generation. Look, if you treat political prisoners like common thieves, don't be shocked when they find a way to make you regret it. And speaking of the IRA, the 1984 Brighton bombing is still the gold standard for how to terrify a government. They didn't just target a random building. They put a bomb in the hotel where Margaret Thatcher and her entire cabinet were sleeping during the Conservative Party conference. It was a cold, strategic calculation that proved the IRA could get to anyone, anywhere, regardless of how many cops were outside. Thatcher survived by a fluke, but the message stuck. You have to be lucky every day. We only have to be lucky once. Truly chilling shit, honestly. Anyway, that's what's on the radar.